cancercenter.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Last year, government officials arrested nearly 5 dozen people in the United States for helping to support or plot with the Islamic State, the largest number of terrorism-related arrests in the country in a single year since September 2001. That number included a 19-year-old from Morganton who now faces the death penalty. A recent study by Georgetown University also reports American recruits defy any single profile, although they are younger than previous terrorism suspects, are drawn heavily from converts to Islam, and reflect increasingly prominent roles for women within the terrorist organization. To most Americans, the allure of ISIS is unfathomable. Why would anyone feel drawn to an organization whose acts of barbarism are unparalleled? For answers, and in the absence of those, at least for some insight, we turn to Dr. Cindy Combs and Seamus Hughes, a co-author of that study I just mentioned. Dr. Combs is professor of political science at UNC Charlotte and an expert on terrorism and terrorist groups who, in the aftermath of 9/11, was on this program numerous times to shed light on the machinations and ideology of al-Qaeda. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
She's in our studio, and with us from Washington, D.C. is Seamus Hughes, Deputy Director of the Program on Extremism at the Center for Cyber and Homeland Security at George Washington University. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
First of all, Seamus, tell us a little bit about the Program on Extremism at the Center for Cyber and Homeland Security at George Washington University. Why is it there?
Yeah, so we just launched a relatively new program. We launched in June. We wanted to take a nuanced look at extremism in the U.S. I think we see a number of times in media and then in the general public discussion, it's much more alarmist, right? So we wanted to take an empirical look at terrorism and extremism in all forms. So our first report was looking at ISIS recruits in America and a six-month study of every legal document that you can think of to figure out, who are these folks that are drawn to this ideology?
Before we talk about who are these people who are drawn to this ideology, is there a silver lining in that report? The fact that we have arrested so many people who and the number of people far exceeds the number of attacks that we've experienced, at least in this country. Does that mean we have a handle on this, that law enforcement has a handle on this?
I think it's fair to say that we're in a better position than other countries. So in Europe, we have about 5,000 to 7,000 Westerners who have traveled to places like Syria and Iraq. In the U.S., we're talking about much smaller numbers. 250 Americans have attempted or have traveled. So I think law enforcement has the tools that other European countries don't have, and they're able to essentially be more proactive on this. The question becomes whether it becomes overwhelming. So we had 61 arrests last year. Usually we have about 20 to 30. I think we're seeing a number, and I talked to a number of FBI agents who say, they're triaging cases. They're doing the best they can with the active number of investigations. I think we're okay right now, but we may reach a tipping point at some point.
So, Dr. Combs, I don't know how much you know about the law enforcement aspect of this, but are these arrests made possible because of local law enforcement? Are they made possible because of a federal effort, a combined effort, the fact that citizens are speaking out when they see something that is suspicious? What's going on here?
It's a combined effort. At the local level, one of the things we've done a lot very well, and we're doing it very well in Charlotte here, is connecting for the local police to connect with the Muslim community to build a relationship that says if you have a concern about someone here, talk to us. If you are concerned about your young people, here's some counseling we can help with. And that relationship makes it so that it's not a matter of having to just use surveillance and hope we can see it as they get online, because since groups like ISIS are using Twitter as well as Facebook and others, it's very difficult to catch all of that. But if you have the community concerned and sharing with you their concerns, you're much more likely to anticipate the problem. And the problem looks much larger because then, in turn, they're able to say there are several. There are a lot that you haven't targeted that we see as a problem. So it's good. It's a little terrifying to know how many are potentially at risk and how many communities aren't yet necessarily networked all the way in to where they're sharing with the local community. The hard part there is getting local communities and the FBI to work together in responding to this without just a quick shutdown, but instead trying to reach out in a positive way.
I said in the beginning that American recruits to terrorism, and I believe this comes from the George Washington study, the people who make good targets for radicalization defy any single profile. But how can that be? There must be some sort of a thread running through all these people that we have seen arrested so far. Seamus?
Yeah, unfortunately, there's not a typical profile. They tend to be younger. So the average age of an individual that's been arrested is 26. But in one-third of the cases, they're 21 years or younger. They also tend to be male. But it runs the gamut, right? So we have young, we have old, you know, a 15-year-old and a 47-year-old. We have rich, poor, we have college-educated and high school kids. So it defies kind of easy analysis.
Are most of them native-born?
Yeah, actually, the vast majority are U.S. citizens. So when we talk about homegrown terrorism, we really mean homegrown terrorism. They're individuals who have grown up here and have been attracted either online or in person to this ideology, and they're wanting to travel.
One of the things that you point out, Dr. Combs, is that those most likely to be recruited are young people who don't feel connected to things around them.
Well, 17 to 19-year-olds, and sociologists, psychologists make this clear, are the most likely to be feeling a lot of angst. They're not sure exactly where they're going, what the next step is. Graduating from high school and looking at an 8-to-5 job is not as attractive if you can be offered online a chance to have a bigger role in the world and in the changes you think need to happen. You're frustrated. You aren't sure where you're going or whether anybody's doing anything. And the bad part here is that ISIS is smart. They're not doing what Al-Qaeda did in a kind of a generic videos out. They're doing hundreds of videos targeting different ages, different ethnic groups, different languages. They don't publish as Al-Qaeda used to, mostly in Arabic. They publish it in a wide range of different languages targeting specific groups. So they're not just doing a general call.
How are the disaffected young people who might be attracted to the message of ISIS different, or are they different from the young people who participated in the Columbine shootings or the Aurora, Colorado theater shooting?
That's an excellent example, because the young people in the Columbine high school shootings were two young people who felt, in effect, not really connected. They had looked for and felt alienated. They didn't connect with their peers or with most of the other friends in the area. They were looking for something that would help them come together, and they fed off each other as well as off what they were getting off the internet. Usually that takes – you need somebody else who sees it as you do. The thing that Al-Qaeda is doing is having a young person be the one that you contact back. If you're targeting a young person, then the person responding to that has to be another young person who can talk their language. And that – is scary, because most of what we were getting here were not, say, militia groups who were targeting young people to pull them in. This was people, young people surfing to try to find something to hook onto.
Murder is murder. The kids that participated in the Columbine shootings committed murder. And were willing to die in the process of doing that. Terrorists are willing to commit murder and willing to die in the act of terrorism. So, Seamus, as director of the program on extremism at Georgetown, do you see any difference between these, what we would, I guess, would call distinct motivations?
Yeah, I think there is a difference. I mean, listen, they're all drawing on the same type of recruits, right? The disenfranchised and the people that are looking to be something bigger than themselves. But the motivations are different. I mean, clearly ISIS has a worldview that it's pushing, and it's pushing pretty effectively online, particularly on Twitter and Telegram. So it's a different dynamic, which means it's a different way to counter it. You know, you're not using the same tools that you would for a militia group or a white supremacist group. There are some parallels, but not exclusively so.
We don't seem to be able to spot these young people very often. That we didn't spot the Columbine shooters. The parents didn't notice anything terribly wrong, or at least maybe they thought something was odd, but they saw that as teenage behavior. All of these young people, all these people that we've arrested, I think at least 200 people from the United States have traveled or tried to travel to Syria. 50 were arrested. Is the problem here that these people are so young that they make bad decisions, and we who observe that just chalk it up to bad decision-making on the part of young people, and it's a phase they're going through? As opposed to, these people are really dangerous and we need to intercept them now before they do anything and help them find their way in the world.
One of the countries that has gone that route is Norway, and they've done a really good job of putting together what you'd call it's a group called, in effect, Just Unity. And what they are doing is trying to help Muslim youth find ways to connect. And as they do it, they spend – it's very manpower intensive because you have to spend time with the young people to try to find out, why is it that you're so angry? Is it because your parents are putting too many rules down? Is it because you want a career and that's not what they want for you? Is it because – you know, what's the root of the anger?
But it's one thing to be angry. It's another thing to be attracted to a group that beheads people and tortures people and rapes people and just is merciless in every – and dictatorial in every way.
But you see, ISIS is doing – okay, one of their key phrases is, don't hear about us, hear from us. They haven't used the media except to terrify people in a general sort of way with the public beheadings. What they do, if you look at most of their broadcasts, they're celebrating. They're looking like young people who are incredibly happy, doing really good things to help. A lot of the young women who've been recruited in thought they were going in to help in a kind of a humanitarian way with the situation in Syria and find themselves instead pulled in to be prostitutes in an ISIS camp. That's not what they thought they were going for. But the propaganda going out says you can help. You can be important. You can do good things.
What are the messages that – go ahead, Seamus. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's an interesting dynamic here. You know, when you look at – we looked at about 8,000 pages of legal documents, and I talked to a number of families of individuals who got arrested. And there's something called the bystander effect, right? So in about 70% of the cases, a family member or a loved one recognized that their son was radicalized into violence. The issue becomes they don't know what to do with it. So in at least five cases, they hid the passports of their sons, you know, hoping they wouldn't travel. You know, another one went so extreme as, you know, he beat him up, his 19-year-old son up, and to try to stop him from, you know, getting on a plane. A mother traveled to Turkey to try to bring his son back. So you see these like ad hoc intervention approaches by these family members, but they're not sure what to do with it, right? There's no systematic way. There's no hotline to call. There's no religious leader who's, you know, standing up and saying, I can help you on these type of things. So you have these families that are struggling with these issues and they just have no avenue for prevention.
In the case of the 19-year-old from Morganton, Justin Sullivan, his father turned him in. His father's a former military person and saw him going awry and turned him in and said it was the most difficult thing he'd ever done, as one might imagine, but it was the right thing to do. Do most people see it that way, if you're a parent?
It's a difficult choice. I mean, you have two options, right? One is you kind of hope it's a phase. You know, they grow out of it. It's teenage angst and things like that. Or you call the FBI, potentially talk to your loved one behind a prison bar for the next 20 years. That's an untenable position to put a family member in. The vast majority do reach out to law enforcement because they understand that it's better for them, their sons, to be in jail than to be killed in Syria and Iraq. But it's a difficult choice to make.
We all see the results of what ISIS is doing in Syria, the destruction of antiquities, the beheadings, that's the least of it, the beheadings and the horrible things that they do to other people, and this idea that they want to establish a caliphate, which I want to talk about as we go through this program. We see those messages in mass media. They're horrific. What is the message behind the scenes that counteracts the horrific nature of what we're seeing in the mass media that is attractive to young people in America who grew up in this culture, not that culture?
If you look at what's coming through on Twitter, and as he mentioned, Telegram, the idea of being able to have a dedicated line where someone can effectively tune in and listen to a sermon, what amounts to a sermon.
Yeah, but you can't deny that. I'm sure they don't deny what they've done. They have physically, publicly beheaded people. So what is it that they could possibly say to attract me into their organization?
That theirs were responses to the horrendous things being done to the Sunni people in Iraq and Syria, to the devastating economic situations most of them are dealing with in housing and food and all the other things they don't have. What they were trying to do is to change the world for them.
Dr. Cindy Combs from UNC Charlotte, a terrorism expert. Seamus Hughes is also with us from the George Washington University Center for Cyber and Homeland Security. We're taking a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting Once, an original Broadway love story about going for your dreams and the power of music to connect all of us. Tomorrow through Sunday in Bell Theater. Tickets at BlumenthalArts.org. In the news this week, North Carolina is getting hammered for the legislature's move to overturn Charlotte's LGBT ordinance. Fallout is coming from all corners. Meanwhile, Charlotte's fire chief survives after a closed city council meeting investigating a leaked memo. Charlotte gets a first-of-its-kind report on the entrepreneur scene here, even as we start getting some population growth competition. Those stories and more all during our local weekly news roundup tomorrow on this program at 9.
On the next Diane Reen Show, a new report finds that family members who care for loved ones with Alzheimer's make major financial sacrifices, like cutting back on work hours and selling personal belongings. Why Alzheimer's is one of the most costly diseases for families.
Join the Diane Reem Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guests today are Dr. Cindy Combs, professor of political science and a terrorism expert from UNC Charlotte. Also, Seamus Hughes, deputy director of the Program on Extremism at the Center for Cyber and Homeland Security at George Washington University. In Brussels, they're uncovering all of these people that have been, I guess, sleeper cells for ISIS. And they've been there for a while, and we first became aware of this concentration as a result of the Paris attack. They're living amongst people who surely knew that they were suspect, and yet they weren't turned in. Is that because these people are fellow sympathizers, or is it because they just don't want to get involved? And we have a problem like this in America, too, it would seem to me.
And Belgium has the problem of a divided society between the Flemish, in effect, and the Belgian populations, two different languages they want, two different types of culture. You remember they went for about a year without a government because they couldn't agree on how they would govern together. Mm-hmm. So you have some already disconnects there. You also have in the Malbec area where these people had come from a serious shortfall. There were about 185 unfilled police office space people there, most of them in the ones who were supposed to be doing the community policing because they just didn't have the money or the focus of saying this is what we need to do. So you're going to be not getting that the connection that says, here, tell us about it, this is a problem, because you're understaffed and overworked, you don't have it. And they didn't see it as a critical problem because, again, they had so much else they were dealing with, they didn't even look this way. So from the community part, they're not reaching out because they are already overwhelmed with what they're having to deal with. From the Moroccans who are living there, if this has been a pattern for a period of time, it's not going to be an aberration. It's going to be the way you deal. That is, the Moroccan community would be separate from everyone else and not necessarily interacting. And that's something Belgium is now trying to work out. Where did we fall short? Should we have had a hotline? It's one of the things they've mentioned several times in the last few days about the need in communities for a hotline, somebody so that you could call so that even if your local police are not involved, there's somebody to talk to about what you think may be going wrong. They didn't have it. I believe they'll build it.
Here in this country, are we more concerned about individuals being inspired to use their passports and get on an airplane and go over there and be part of ISIS, or are we more worried about them doing copycat or, I guess copycat's the word, acts of terrorism in this country? Or is that, in a sense, the same thing, joining ISIS by simply doing it here?
Well, you saw the thing with the Morganton young man. He was not asked to go and recruit and go over to fight. He was basically recruited to come and carry out acts here. You're getting more and more the push that says instead of coming here to fight, they're losing some of the ground war there. It's less critical that they have physical presence on the ground than that they hurt and destabilize countries like ours.
And although in the last segment, Seamus, we did say there was kind of a silver lining in the fact that we have more arrests than we have active terrorist acts. But you say that the U.S. has lagged behind in creating a comprehensive strategy for countering violent extremism. Who are we lagging, and why are we lagging? Who and why?
Yeah, there's two reasons why I think we're lagging. One is we haven't had a forcing function, meaning that our numbers have never risen to a level where we had to do a comprehensive prevention strategy. And I think the reason why we're lagging is that we haven't figured this out, right? There's no typical profile. There's not a checklist of individuals of how you stop them. And so you have – and you're hitting against a number of issues, whether it's free speech, freedom of expression, religious issues that governments are uncomfortable in getting into that space. So we're about 5 years behind our European partners on countering violent extremism. And again, we haven't figured out that middle way, meaning between doing nothing and arrest, you know, that intervention space where a family member can call and say, I'm worried about my kid, but I don't want him to end up in jail, or at least that could be the last result.
Let's get back to this.
Go ahead. If you don't, I want to go back a little bit in terms of should we be worried about attacks here. When you look at the data of the individuals who've been arrested, the vast majority were interested in joining the so-called caliphate. So that was a driver, right? So it was less about domestic plotting and much more about going to Syria and Iraq. The interesting dynamic, and we at the Program on Extremism at George Washington have been looking at for about 6 months the Twitter feeds of ISIS American supporters in the U.S. to get a sense of that scene. And we're seeing a number of people saying, don't come here, do what you can where you are because it's too hard to travel now. It's not as easy as it used to be. So we may see a shift in terms of targeting.
Let's talk about this idea of establishing a caliphate. That would mean that they want to establish Islamic hegemony over that part of the world and perhaps eventually the entire world. Is that what's really going on here? Because the acts that they commit in the name of Islam, I don't think are Islamic. Is it really that, or is it a bunch of disaffected rabble-rousers who are just bullies and murderers and butchers?
I think you may have a combination of them. And you're right in saying most of what ISIS does is not acceptable. Most Muslims do not like it. It does not fit Islam. It's not what Islam is called for. But there is a problem. After World War I, there was up until World War I, there had been a continuous caliphate, which had been the leadership of the Sunni branch of Islam. After World War I, they were a part of the Ottoman Turks, and that was what we said was the losers, in effect, in the war, and the caliphate was dismantled. So they blamed the West for having taken away the Sunni did, for having taken away their leadership. It'd be like, say, getting rid of the Vatican, and what would Catholics do if that were taken apart, destroyed, and there's not a pope there? Mm. They want it back. So what you're getting is someone who's playing on that desire of Sunnis to have a leadership type of
And the
area.
Shiites don't want the same thing, but on their side of the coin?
Do not what?
Want the same thing, but on their side of the coin?
What they're looking at is that they want a leadership kind of like the Vatican-type leadership that would be the head of the church. Mm-hmm. The Shia don't want it. This is where the divide was for how leadership is done. So you're getting Sunnis who've said, now we've gone for decades, almost a century, without a leadership piece here, and we want it. We need it. So ISIS is playing on that. It's not just a state they want. They want an Islamic state that acts as a caliphate for the whole of the Sunni branch of Islam. That's a huge step, and much more than al-Qaeda ever wanted. They didn't want to be a state. They wanted, in effect, a linked and open Islam global. But this is different.
Now, here in this country, you're saying, Seamus, that more money needs to be brought to bear on this. I believe that's what you're saying, more coordination of efforts at various different levels. Surely there must be the political will to make that happen. Is there?
There is now. There wasn't before. So in 2011, the White House came out with their countering violent extremism strategy, and expressly in the document it says there would be no new resources for this. I think that dynamic has quickly changed. The administration's rejiggered their organization. They put DHS as a lead. The Congress has allocated about $10 million toward this project. So you may see more programs coming online in the next few months because I think there's recognition that, listen, 84 individuals arrested in the legal system is a small number, but it's unprecedented for the U.S., and we need to wrap our heads around that.
We've talked about how social media is playing a role in this. It must be playing a very big role because prior to the existence of social media and prior to the existence of the interconnected world through the 24-hour news cycle and the internet – what did these disaffected people do? You didn't hear about them. We didn't have very many mass shootings going on all the time. What happened to the people who were disaffected then?
ISIS has been radicalizing, not just connecting with a disaffected person. A lot of us are disaffected at some point in your life where things don't seem to connect. You're not going where you thought you were. Yeah. Things aren't coming together. The radicalization is the scary part, because what you're doing is saying, not only do you not really connect right now, but let me give you something to connect to that's exciting.
But it's a big leap to go from being disaffected and finding something to belong to strapping on a suicide vest and blowing yourself up and killing hundreds of people. That's a big leap.
Large leap. Yes, it is. And it's not an overnight thing. That's what we have to understand. Someone doesn't just listen to one radio broadcast or one talk to one Twitter for a day or two and suddenly decide they're going to be a suicide bomber.
Yeah.
It is a process, and it does require steps, which gives us time to intervene if we can see it happening, to be able to stop that process. The difficulty is recidivism. If they've already gone through that edge, it's hard to be able to pull back. It's easier to be able to stop the radicalization, because that is a process, than it is to identify as you find them.
So it's easier to give them a reality check and give them a smack
and
make them see what they're doing, as it is to bring them back from the edge. Okay.
Also remember, though, that the general public is not a very patient. They want a muscular approach to what's happening with ISIS. Mm-hmm. That's why there's a demand to send some troops over. Why are we not bombing ISIS? Why can't we take care of it this way? Taking care of it on a one-on-one basis at the local community isn't satisfying to the general public and doesn't generate money in terms of public demand and public will to make that change.
Should we be doing that? You're the terrorism expert. Is that what we should be doing?
Yes. I think it's a lot more productive to try to stop it generating here, to interrupt the generation and try to, in effect, prevent it, than it is to try to hit hard after it happens.
And in fact, you have said that the military is being put in a no-win situation of clearly identifying enemies and developing a plan for taking them down.
Yeah, putting them in a war on terror when you haven't identified who the enemy is and you can't tell who the good guys and bad guys are. You can fail to shoot someone because you're not sure that they generally have a suicide vest on. Mm-hmm. If they do have a suicide vest, you and your 20 people with you, your rest of your unit is destroyed. If you shoot them and they don't have that on, you can go to jail. Yeah. You put them in an impossible situation.
Right. You wrote an article in the Washington Post, Seamus, in which you say that ISIS isn't just selling itself on ideological and political grounds, but as hip counterculture. What is hip or countercultural about murder or mayhem?
Right. So you don't need to appeal to a large number of people. So there's about 30,000 foreign fighters that have traveled in the last year, right? So you're not trying to get a large number. What you're trying to do is push a positive message. We talk a lot about these beheadings that we see on the nightly news, and those are important messaging that ISIS puts out. But the vast, vast majority of their propaganda is much more of a has much more of a positive spin, or what they perceive to be a positive spin. So it's about the building the so-called caliphate. It's about electricity in Raqqa and handing candy out to kids. It's about being for something. And I also think it's important to note, you know, it's not like if Twitter goes away tomorrow, we won't have the same number of people. You know, what happens in Raqqa will determine what happens in terms of the number of Americans that are joining. It is a draw, and that physical space is attracting a number of people. They're also very adept at using social media. So they use Twitter in ways that are so creative that, you know, government can't keep up, just the system of government being what it is.
You also their message is crafted artfully. I mean, they really do a wonderful job of it's highly technical. It's almost Hollywood in some cases in its quality, and it hits the hot buttons that they need to hit. So they're not only filmmakers, but they're psychologists. How did that come to be?
Most of the leadership, both of Al-Qaeda and ISIS, are not stupid people who didn't graduate from grade school. A good percentage of them are ones who have masters and doctorates in specific fields, have long experience in, and so they're not unable to draw real talent, and they want that real talent because they understand the value of having someone who can't just rant on the corner but can present it in a way that's going to be attractive to technologically savvy young people.
The recent leaks of ISIS files in the last month or so, it kind of gives a window to it, right? So when you walk in as a foreign fighter, they ask you a series of questions, and one of them is, you know, what's your skill level? And if you have skills in media and things like that, you're immediately pulled out of that front line and you're put into a position. And propagandists are actually paid more than the fighters are in ISIS. They also, film the beheadings in many different angles so they can cut the video exactly right. So they understand that this is a medium that will help attract people, and so they're putting their resources towards that.
Thankfully, we haven't seen any beheadings or many beheadings in recent months. They've seemed to decline. Is that because they've changed their strategy, or is it because the – I've forgotten his name, Jihadi John or whatever his name was taken out by our forces, and it was one guy's idea that I'm going to do this, and now that he's gone, they don't do that anymore.
Yeah, I think unfortunately, I think we're still seeing that those very violent images. The issue is it's not necessarily Westerners, so you don't necessarily see it on the nightly news every day. But they clearly have shifted their strategy away from and focusing much more on military victories, meaning that they're understanding that they're getting pushback and saying that ISIS is losing territory. So if you look at the recent propaganda, it's much more, we just retook this town, we're advancing, and it's trying to push a motive that they're growing.
But they are in fact not growing. They are in fact being pushed back by the forces fighting against them. Is that why they've intensified what they're doing in Europe?
It's at least part of the reason, because again, if you're saying we're succeeding here and we've taken Mosul and we're moving further out and that's no longer true and you're having to say we're losing ground, then you need to say to your people, create some chaos where you are. Mm-hmm. Show that we're still active in other ways and this is not the only front on which we're fighting. Part of the reason why the loss, the stopping of the visuals of beheadings was that, you know, it was done for America because we would not pay ransom. We said we were not going to do it. Other countries, including France, Belgium, and a number of others, had paid ransom to get their people back. We said no, so they said fine. Public beheading, make the point. When they did that, we started committing a lot more resources to the war in Syria. That is, both everything from drone attacks to all kinds of training and equipment. If you make the war there harder by doing something like this, that's not a productive idea. They're not stupid. They look at it and realize that had it had an impact, and it was good up to a point, but it's a negative impact. It didn't mean they were going to go ahead and put money in the coffers. It meant they put people into the fight here. Not a good thing.
There are nations that are paying ransom for these
yes.
people, and we do not. We at least publicly, we have a policy of not doing so. And I don't believe we're doing it behind the scenes. Other countries have a public policy of not doing so, but they are doing it behind the scenes. Which is the right tactic?
Realistically, if you give money, ISIS initially was existing on the ransom money that was coming in. Now they have a lot of other flows of sources and others donating in. But the ransom money was a key factor at the beginning. It is important that you not let that be the primary pipeline by which they're funded. Hmm. The reason we said publicly we won't is not to get someone publicly beheaded, but to make clear the point, you can go ahead and try to kidnap Americans, but it's a waste of your time because you're not going to get anything out of it. Hmm. That means you go ahead and kill them, but it does mean there's no point in kidnapping for ransom. So you make your point. If you back off on it, then your Americans continue to be kidnapped and publicly beheaded.
In the aftermath of a lot of these attacks, both here and around the world, we always ask the question, people always ask the question, why do they hate us? And when it comes to recruiting those who would commit these acts of terror, you say they don't hate us as much as they are just not really connected to the rest of us. So are we asking the wrong question?
In some ways, no. There is a sense in which hatred is there because you're going to have to focus that anger and angst and dissatisfaction against an enemy. You're not going to do it against a kind of a general sense of Western. You have to do it against an enemy. In order to be able to carry out a terrorist act, if I'm going to kill you, I have to see you as a monster, evil. And that means I have to be able to hate you rather than just seeing you as another person who could be blown up. So there is a sense in which we should be realize that there are a lot of people out there who are being radicalized to hate us. And that's a scary thought when you're getting that many who are radicalized to be willing to see you as a monster that needs to be destroyed.
Is that what's happening in social media to people who live in this country? Or are they being told that your fellow Americans are monsters and people are buying into it?
Take a look at what happened to the young man in Morganton. He was preparing to go out and kill 1,000 people.
Right. And he'd already killed his next door neighbor to get
right.
the money to do it.
To do it.
Yeah.
So yes, you're radicalizing here to say these are the people around you are monsters who need to be destroyed.
I should say allegedly.
Allegedly.
Killed.
That's true.
Because he has not been put on trial for that, I don't believe. When we come back, I want to talk about the Constitution and our cherishment of freedom of speech and religious liberty and how and if that hurts us in our fight to uncover these cells of radical terrorists. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Robinson Bradshaw, committed to providing collaborative legal solutions to the business community, offices in Charlotte, Rock Hill, and the Research Triangle, robinsonbradshaw.com. And from Charlotte Symphony, presenting Nature Tales, a Lollipops concert for children 4 through 10 at Night Theater with puppets by former Sesame Street puppeteer Victor Urid this Saturday. Details at charlottesymphony.org. Addressing the unanticipated consequences of the U.S. highway system and urban renewal. Guess who's on the Diane Rehm Show to talk about that in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock? It would be former Charlotte Mayor and U.S. Secretary of Transportation Anthony Fox on helping isolated, poor, and minority communities get access to reliable and safe transportation. That's all upcoming in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation, email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Look for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter at Charlotte Talks.
When college students in Texas head to class, they can take their laptops and their books and now their guns.
What if there is somebody on campus who, you know, wants to use that gun for harmful purposes? If I had to choose a side, I wouldn't want guns on campus.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The new open carry law on campuses in the Lone Star State. That is next time on Marketplace.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Seamus Hughes, Deputy Director of the Program on Extremism at the Center for Cyber and Homeland Security at George Washington University. He joins us from studios there. And Dr. Cindy Combs is in our studio. She is a political scientist and an expert on terrorism and terrorist activity around the world. She's at UNC Charlotte. How much of the problem, Seamus, or how much of a problem does the Constitution and our protections of free speech and our traditions of religious liberty play in all of this in helping to uncover or hindering our efforts to uncover cells or individuals who might be inclined to become part of ISIS?
It's an interesting dynamic, but I don't think it's a limiting factor.
Okay.
So the FBI has the ability to open an investigation if it's speech plus action, so communicating with a known or suspected terrorist. What's an interesting dynamic we're seeing play out in recent cases is what that real line is. So in Ohio, you have a guy named Terrence McNeil who's currently arrested for posting a GIF on his Tumblr page with the addresses of DOD soldiers and saying, kill them. In Missouri, you have a 38-year-old woman who was arrested for retweeting a threat towards an FBI agent. So you're getting these cases that are going to play out in the legal system, which raises a whole host of free speech issues in terms of communicating a threat. It's fascinating dynamic. We'll see it play out.
And there's so much on social media. I mean, it's literally more information than one could digest in 10,000 lifetimes at any given moment in time. So is law enforcement depending on citizens to see this and point it out to them?
Yeah, I think they're always relying on you know, see something, say something. What's the problem with this issue is, you know, the FBI talks about some 900 active investigations in all 50 states. The vast, vast majority of individuals that are espousing this ideology are never going to cross that line into violent action. So it becomes a very difficult dynamic of when you introduce an informant or when you decide to build a case. When you don't have, you know, signs of when someone's going to make that jump into militancy. So it becomes very difficult to go through, you know, the 900 cases and decide, okay, this is where we approach.
And most of the people who are attracted to this and who actually start planning an attack, either here or elsewhere, are very secretive about this. That's why the thing in San Bernardino, you don't tell workers, you don't tell friends, you don't tell your family that you're doing this. Just one day you do it. So are there any signs that people can spot to short-circuit these kinds of activities?
If there were a simple go ahead, sorry.
No, I would say that, you know, the ones that are most effective in terms of attacks tend not to say anything. But in the vast majority of the cases that we looked at, you know, they're fervent in their beliefs. They want to convince people that their worldview is right, so they're spouting their mouth off pretty regularly. The issue always becomes if someone says, oh, you know, that's just my friend and he says crazy stuff on Facebook and I may ignore it, or when someone just says, this is concerning, I should call law enforcement, it's not a clear line. And they're not, you know, they're not a checklist of if this individual does 10 things, he's going to become a terrorist. Mm. You know, radicalization is not a linear process. People go in and out of it, and it's highly individualized and very complex, which makes the problem set so much harder.
Plus, I would think that if you notice something that is odd among a person in your family or the next-door neighbor, it might be difficult to turn that person in because we treat – or I guess the question is, do we treat – my impression is that we do treat people who are potential terrorists more severely than we might an arsonist. Do we?
I think that – yeah, I think that's absolutely true.
So you'd better be right when you turn that person in, right?
Yeah, and also our responses to it are different, right? So when you look at gang prevention, if you have a young individual who joins a gang, there are avenues to pull that individual out without law enforcement. When an individual tries to join a group like ISIS, there are no programs to be able to pull them out. And I think – I'm not sure society is at that point, which is – understandable but concerning in terms of resource perspective, right? You want to be able to get the low-hanging fruit, you know, off the table so you're able to focus on the real and immediate threats like the individual in San Bernardino.
Like others, Justin – I can't think of his name now – Justin Sullivan from Morganton, the 19-year-old who was arrested and who actually did commit a allegedly committed a murder to fund his activities. He was in communication with an undercover FBI agent and was encouraging that FBI agent in some way to prove that he would be willing to join Justin in his efforts to kill 1,000 people. Neither of them had done anything, and he didn't know that the FBI agent was undercover. It could have been another like-minded individual. If they haven't done anything yet, they're just talking about it on the internet, what's the charge?
Part of that's on the issue of how our terrorism laws are constructed and not terribly constructed. We haven't defined clearly enough in the four different agencies that deal with terrorism exactly what terrorism is. So it's difficult to convict clearly on what is only going to be a terrorist act. Mm-hmm. So what you're doing is saying this individual has been conspiring to commit such an act, planning to. So if you conspire to commit a bank robbery, you're still guilty of a crime. It is a crime not yet taken out but still there. You'd rather catch them when they're conspiring to commit than after they've done it and hope you can recover from whatever they did. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to focus on catching them. But I think Sean has a point. That is, the ones who are going to be caught easily are going to be the ones who are not really good at it, who are passionate but don't know enough to be able to hold that passion in and focus it toward where they want it to go and keep it below radar.
This is one of the many instances of where an individual plotting terrorism was in communication with an undercover law enforcement officer. Is law enforcement constantly trolling? Are there places to go in the so-called dark web, or is this out in the open on people's Facebook pages? How does it work?
It's going to be both, because you're going to have some who are foolish enough to put it up. Facebook is like a billboard. So if you put it up on Facebook and even on the chats in Facebook, it's trackable and easily accessed. Twitter's a little harder. Doing it on internet takes a little more in terms of surveillance capabilities. So you're getting kind of graded differences in not only commitment but intelligence in what you're doing. Our problem is that you don't have enough manpower in the FBI or in your local police to continuously troll all of these different kinds of sites, to set up algorithms, yes, to look for certain terms and phrases and, identifying pieces in those communications. But again, you're still going to get hundreds of thousands because students do research in it and they go to those sites. Students talk to each other about it and that word comes up in their discussion.
I would think that most of the people, young people who are attracted to this, do not consider themselves to be criminals, do they? Have most of them committed criminal acts?
No, I mean, they're fervent believers in what they're doing. So the reason I'm talking to a number of
it's okay. We're in different studios in different cities, and we can't communicate with each other.
I apologize.
No, that's okay. Go right ahead.
So right now I'm talking to a a foreign fighter on Twitter and to get a sense of his scene. He doesn't see himself as a criminal, right? He does also doesn't see himself as a terrorist. You know, he sees the U.S. and West as that. Mm-hmm. So he has a worldview. And the reason why he has that worldview is because there's an echo chamber both online and in person. So the individuals that are drawn to this ideology go to places like Twitter and Telegram, and they're only hearing the voices they want to hear. They're not hearing dissenting voices. And a similar dynamic plays out in terms of clusters of individuals in the U.S. You know, they're only hearing their friends that agree with them. There is no other views.
So it's like a cult, a national internet-based cult. The reason I asked about the criminal side of this is that as law enforcement in Belgium is looking into the perpetrators of the attacks in Paris and Belgium, they are coming to find that many of the people were already known to them because they had committed criminal activities, car theft, burglary, and the fact that many of these people are not really Muslim, even though they're committing these acts. They are Muslims, but they work in bars and places that would not be considered places that Islamic believers would be. So when word of this gets out to the average rank-and-file potential recruit in America, don't they see that as hypocritical or antithetical to what they're being told in these private messages? These are criminals.
Most of the ones who are going to carry out a terrorist attack don't look at the law the same way we do and saying criminal acts. If you're going to be willing to carry out the kind of attack that a terrorism requires, you can't worry about whether it's breaking the law. So saying they're criminals says they've broken the law, but if you're already moving in that direction to carry out terrorist acts, you're not worried about what man's law is.
But, you know, shooting a policeman and stealing a car and doing other things like that, that's not considered a criminal activity by young people?
Depends on, again, if you're looking at someone who's moving toward the radicalization, they're going to be rationalizing it based on you're doing it for the cause. You're doing it for a law higher than your law, than the man's law here.
So for American recruits, you're saying, Seamus, I believe, that by and large they have not committed criminal activities, unlike the people in Belgium, correct?
Yeah, you actually, when you look at the cases, the vast majority don't have a criminal background. So, you know, some of them do you know, student loan fraud in order to finance their trip to Syria, but the vast majority don't have a criminal record.
So these young converts who are being trolled or targeted by ISIS in this country, who then are attracted to the message, are they attracted to the message because they see these people as being put upon and mistreated by the West, or because they are attracted to the religion, because some of them do convert to Islam to do this? What's going on in their minds? Do they see a connection between Islam and the terrorist activity, or is it merely, I could belong to that group and do great things in the world?
Yeah, I mean, each person is different when you look at the dynamics. Actually, when you look at the cases, 38% were converts to Islam, which is a higher percentage than the general population of American Muslims. So you have a number of individuals who essentially convert to ISIS, not Islam. But you also have individuals that are steeped in the faith. You know, they grew up going to Islamic schools and were Hafiz and things like that. So it runs the gamut on that dynamic too. You know, they see themselves as performing and implementing a strict literalist interpretation of Islam, and we can debate whether they're correct or not, but that's how they see the world.
But these are people who kill innocent people. These are people who kill children.
Again,
what's attractive about that? What would be – how warped are you that would be okay in your mind?
Think of it this way.
This is an interesting
– go ahead. That's all right.
It's an interesting dynamic. So after the attack in Pakistan at the school, mm-hmm. or at the park, one of the individuals I talked to, who's a foreign fighter, reached out to me and said, "Isn't this great news? We killed 70 children." And I said, you know, we had a back and forth, a philosophical discussion of, you know, how are you killing children? He said, I don't see them as children. They're non-believers. They're allowed to be killed. So if you have a warped worldview, you're able to justify anything.
And the other half of it is this. You realize that we assume there everyone is looking at the news reports as we see them. A lot of the newer converts, as they're pulled in, as they're being radicalized, are being told to go onto these channels and these only. Mm-hmm. Talk to us on this Twitter line, this Telegram. you're not supposed to be looking at everything else. And most of us have two or three places we go for news. We don't do a scan of all of the different kinds of news all over the world. You tend to pick two or three you trust. Think of someone who's shifting gears this much. They're going to pick two or three places to get the truth, and they're not going to get it in the form that we're getting it on our general news.
In Europe, officials say the most recent perpetrators that they are uncovering in Brussels aren't so much radical Islamists, but rather Islamized radicals, those who use God as an excuse to justify violence and criminality. Does that change the tactics that we use to fight or uncover these people?
I think that's too due an assessment to be sure that that's right. Initially, after attacks like this, you're going to get a lot of different assessments as to who they were and why they did what they did. And it's going to take a lot more than we have had in a couple of weeks' time to be able to really investigate the individuals, how they were radicalized, what the patterns were. So I'd be hesitant to say that changes everything because that's how they are.
You were on this program 1,000 times in the aftermath of 9/11, Cindy, because we were trying to understand and get to know Al-Qaeda and their thinking and where they came from and what they were all about. Would you say that among adherents to the ideology of Al-Qaeda, that religious belief, no matter how misguided, was a part of what they wanted? Is this, you say yes.
Yes.
Would the same thing be true of ISIS, or is this really just a subversion for power?
It's a combination of that. You have a large percentage who are genuinely pulled into it for religious reasons. They become, in effect, crusaders who see it doing it for a higher cause. Mm-hmm. But when you're getting something that offers a chance to carry out violence, you're right. They're going to be individuals who are effectively sociopathic already and find the idea of doing kind of rationalized violence attractive.
This is a bankrupt ideology, it seems to me. Are there instances of in history of what happens to bankrupt ideologies? Do they go down quickly? Do they last a long time?
They can cause enormous damage in a short period of time. The difficulty is not that they simply go down quickly. If it becomes, in effect, bankrupt in terms of the structure and focus, it can still have a wide enough pull. Look at what Hitler did with Nazis. You had something that was, in some respects, Hitler was himself not Aryan. How could you do something that's based on Aryan? So it was bankrupt at the base.
Right.
But it was able to carry out enormous amount of damage, and we still have Nazi groups today.
Seamus, some people say that the attraction to young people, particularly in this country, to ISIS, is that they have been very successful in overcoming some very powerful forces in that part of the world, in Iraq and in Syria, and that's attractive. But now they're being pushed back. So because they're being pushed back, will that attractiveness diminish?
I'm not sure it will, actually. I think you may actually see more people being drawn because they see ISIS is under attack. And also the interesting dynamic is whether people shift over to other ungoverned spaces, whether it's parts of Libya or Yemen, where if they can't travel to Syria and Iraq, they go to the other individual.
And Seamus Hughes, you get the last word because we're out of time. He is the deputy director of the program on extremism at the Center for Cyber and Homeland Security at George Washington University. Dr. Cindy Combs joined us in our studio, terrorism expert and a professor of political science at UNC Charlotte. Thank you both for the hour.
Thank you.